The final section of this book is about careers, your career. The first chapter is called Finding the Right Job. My feeling is that if you find it, you'll never really work again. There is an old saying that you can only live life forward and understand it backward. The same thing could be said about careers. Every time I ask successful people about their first few jobs, the immediate reaction is almost laughter. The chairman and CEO of Procter & Gamble, A.G. Lafley, thought he was going to be a professor of Renaissance history. That career plan evaporated when he dropped out of graduate school to join the Navy for 2 years, and then spent 6 more running grocery and specialty stores near a Navy base in Tokyo. Or take Meg Whitman. She started her career as a management consultant, then joined Disney to open its first stores in Japan, then moved to Stride Right to revive its Keds brand, then took over the ailing floral company, FTD, and then moved to Hasbro to run its Play School and Mr. Potato Head divisions. It makes perfect sense that Meg Whitman would end up as the CEO of eBay, the retailer of absolutely everything, doesn't it? But there was nothing specifically planned about her career. eBay didn't even exist until a few years ago. The point is, it is virtually impossible to know for sure where any given job will take you. In fact, if you meet someone who has managed to faithfully follow a career plan, try not to get seated beside him at a dinner party. What a bore. I'm obviously not going to tell you to let fate take its course. A great job can make your life exciting and give it meaning. The wrong job can drain the life right out of you. But how do you find the right job? The first answer to that question is simple. You endure the same gummy, time-consuming, up-and-down, iterative process that all working people go through. You take one job, discover what you like and don't like about it, and what you're good and bad at, and then in time change jobs within your company or at another company to get something closer to the right fit. And you do that until one day you realize, hey, I'm finally in the right job. I like what I'm doing, and I'm making the trade-offs I'm willing to make. Yes, trade-offs, because few jobs are perfect. You may love your work with every fiber of your being, but wish the money were better. Or you may only like the work, but love your colleagues. Regardless of its dimensions, the right job for you exists. My goal in this chapter is to make finding that job a somewhat shorter and hopefully less mysterious process. How? Luckily, most jobs send out signals about how right they are for you or not. Those signals apply to jobs at every level of an organization. You can be right out of school, a middle manager trying to move up, or a senior executive looking for a top job. Now, there are special situations in the job search process that require separate consideration. Finding your first job, finding a job if you're stuck in a situation, and finding a job after you've been let go. More about those at the end of this chapter. First, let's look at the general signals, both good and bad, of job fit. Before we talk about each of these signals in more detail, a few thoughts about money, the elephant in the middle of the room during any job discussion. There is nothing worse than a guy who's made some money along the way, opining that money shouldn't matter to people who are picking a job. So I won't do that. In fact, I'll tell you that of course money matters. It matters a lot. When I took my first job, I had several offers, but the one from GE was $1,500 a year more than any other. Coming out of graduate school, I was broke. That $1,500 felt huge, and it made a difference in my decision. A year later, I got my first raise from GE. When I found out that it was exactly the same amount as everyone else in my unit, my fanatical belief in merit pay made me say, forget this place. But I didn't quit until I found another job at a chemical company in Skokie, Illinois, which is going to pay me 25% more. I ultimately ended up being persuaded to stay with GE, but I wouldn't have if the company hadn't matched my salary offer in Skokie. Because there is no way to disentangle money from decisions about job and career, the best you can really do is to come to terms with just how much money matters to you. Just remember, it can feel very noble to say that you don't care about being rich. It's another thing to live with that decision over the years, especially as mortgages and tuitions start to pile up. There is nothing inherently wrong with wanting money or feeling indifferent to it or anything in between. But if you're not honest with yourself about those feelings during the first years of your job journey, you'll end up doing a lot of second-guessing later. Now on to the signals of job fit, which have been listed in no particular order since they all count. That said, the first signal concerns people, because everything else about a job can be perfect, the task, pay, location, but if you do not enjoy your colleagues on a day-to-day basis, work can be torture. This may seem obvious, but I'm surprised how often I meet people who have taken jobs in companies where they do not share the organization's overall sensibilities. By that, I mean a range of values and personality traits and behaviors, from how intense people act, to how comfortable they are with confrontation, to how candid they are about performance, to how much they laugh at meetings. If you join a company where your sensibilities don't fit in, you'll find yourself putting on a persona just to get along. What a career killer to fake who you are every day. I know a woman, we'll call her Claire, who was an MBA who became a manager for a nonprofit after graduation. At first, Claire thought she had the perfect job. She could use her business skills to run an organization and still make the world a better place, to use her words. But several years later, Claire was at her wit's end. Her colleagues made every decision at a snail's pace. It doesn't make any difference if we're picking where to have lunch or coming up with a marketing plan, she recounted. Nobody can ever feel not heard. Everybody has to reach consensus. It's driving me crazy. This organization has all the right intentions, but nothing ever gets done. Finally, Claire decided she could no longer tolerate the sensibilities mismatch she felt in a nonprofit environment, and she began to search for a consulting job in the private sector. She identified one firm in particular that was known for its pro bono work, and she consoled herself with the notion that she could work there and still keep one foot, a toe, in the so-called virtuous world. The problem was the firm wouldn't hire her. You haven't worked at the same speed or with the same kind of intensity we require, they told her. We need someone who can hit the ground running. Basically, they said, we need someone like us. Claire is still at a nonprofit job, resigned to stay there and make the best of it. The sad thing is, she said, I found my people at that consulting firm, but it was too late. They just didn't see I could be like them. You, too, need to find your people. The earlier in your career, the better. Even if a job seems ideal in every other way, without the presence of shared sensibilities, it's not ideal for you. The second job fit signal concerns opportunity, as in how much does the job offer you to grow and learn. Without doubt, it can be very appealing to take a job where you suspect you will have no problem hitting it out of the park. Surefire success has its rewards in the soul and the pocketbook. But any job you take should feel somewhat challenging going in. It should make you think, I can do most of the work, but there are certainly skills and knowledge this job requires that I don't have yet. I'm going to learn something here. In other words, any new job should feel like a stretch, not a layup. Why? Because stretching, growing, learning, all these activities keep you engaged and energized. They have the effect of making work more interesting, and they keep your head in the game. Yes, a stretch job does increase the possibility of you screwing up. That's why you should also make sure you join a company where learning is truly a value. Growth for every employee is a real objective. Mistakes aren't always fatal. And there are lots of people around whom you can reach out to for coaching and mentoring. Incidentally, stretching doesn't and shouldn't just happen at the beginning of a person's career. Take the case of Robert Bagby, who runs the brokerage firm A.G. Edwards. Bob says that he has twice taken on real stretch jobs, 26 years apart. The first was when he began as a broker for another firm in Kansas City. The second time was in 2001, when he was named chairman and CEO of A.G. Edwards. At first, being a broker. My God, I had no idea what I was doing or why I had taken the job, Bob said recently. The phone was like a dangerous weapon. I was afraid to touch it. Within a few months, though, Bob had learned enough new skills to start to excel. He came to love the brokerage business, and soon enough, his territory expanded and promotion started rolling in. He didn't feel out of his element again until the A.G. Edwards board picked him for the top position. It was that same feeling again, Bob says. There's no pre-training to be a CEO. All your past history and all your past successes, they don't really matter anymore. You have to earn your respect all over again. Bob's promotion to CEO couldn't have come at a more challenging time. The internet bubble had burst, and the market was collapsing after 9/11. Bob had to oversee the firm's first workforce reduction and redirect its culture. I'd say it took a year for me to get on solid footing again, he said. Today, things are really back to normal. It's fun now. Bob's story, like so many others, illustrates you shouldn't be afraid of a job that feels too big at the outset. If you're any good, which is why you are hired or promoted in the first place, you'll grow into it and be better for the experience. If the opportunity signal is about finding a job that allows you to grow and stretch while you are there, the option signal is about finding a job that helps you if you leave. Working for some companies is like winning an Olympic medal. For the rest of your career, you are associated with great performance and success. The consulting firm McKinsey & Company is like that. Because it is known to hire the world's top MBAs for their intelligence and intensity, and because of its reputation for intensive training, its alumni always get attention in the job market. By the same token, when I was in my early days of hiring in plastics, we were always trying to hire people away from DuPont, and we considered it a real coup when we did. It may not have been true, but we had it in our heads that if you got a DuPont engineer, you were getting the most cutting-edge knowledge of processes and techniques. Microsoft, Walmart, and Johnson & Johnson also have enormous employee brands, which is to say their people get a real credential just by working there for a few years. Even putting my biases aside, GE is also in this category. Today, 5 of its former employees are CEOs in the Dow Jones 30. Many more are currently CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, and thousands more are executives at companies around the world. Obviously, you cannot let the employee brand phenomenon totally drive your job decisions. You could end up at a highly respected company only to discover your boss is terrible or your job responsibilities are limited. But these kind of situations are less likely at the kind of good companies we're talking about. You may be thinking that I'm writing off small companies with this advice. Not true. Some small companies offer experiences and exposure that cannot be beat. You get a chance to manage people earlier in your career, run projects or units sooner, not to mention negotiate acquisitions and work more closely with the CEO and the board. When you're ready to move on, you won't have the credential of a prestigious company, but you will have a lot of mileage. That really counts at all kinds of places, especially other small companies, venture capital firms, and entrepreneurial startups. There is a second part of the option signal. Some companies open or close doors for you because of their reputation. Others do that because of their industry. Back in the 60s, being in plastics was a ticket to the future. The industry was booming, with new applications being developed every day. In the 70s, because of the energy crisis, you had job offers coming out of your ears if you had a degree or work experience in geology. And of course, people who got involved in high technology and finance in the late 80s and 90s had a good long run of it. At speaking engagements, I am often asked what industries I would recommend to college grads and MBAs today. I tell them to look into companies doing business at the intersection of biology and information technology. And I suggest they learn everything they can about China, because it'll permeate every aspect of business in their lifetimes. This reminds me of something said by a very successful executive I know of who served in the Air Force before he began his business career. He is frequently contacted by headhunters, and he says his first questions about a potential job are just like those he asked as a fighter pilot, assessing situational awareness. When I was on a mission, I would always ask, what's our altitude? What are the weather conditions ahead? Where's the enemy? I think it's the same thing in business, he said. You need to know the same kinds of things about a job or an industry. Are you getting yourself into a turnaround situation? Are the economics fatal? How tough is the competition? Has the industry peaked? Or is it just getting off the ground? Are the expectations of me reasonable? Or am I walking into a time bomb? Now, you can ask these questions and find that the job you like has a problematic future. The airline industry has very tough economics and relatively low pay, especially for managerial positions. The hospitality and publishing industries are likewise not very flush. Still, some people just love the romance of air travel, the adventure of the hotel business, and the excitement of creating books. If you are one of them, of course you should enter these fields. Just do so with your eyes open. Every job you take is a gamble that could increase your options or shut them down. The next signal is about ownership. Who you're really taking a job for. A few years ago, a manager I know was visited in her office by the son of a business acquaintance. He was about to graduate from Harvard, and he needed career advice about two worlds she was very familiar with, investment banking and management consulting. The student hair combed neatly and dutifully dressed in a suit, came prepared with a list of questions. What was the difference, he asked, between the major consulting firms? What kind of assignments could he expect during his first year on Wall Street? And so on. The manager had worked in consulting before joining a consumer goods company and had many acquaintances in investment banking, and so she answered each question thoroughly. She watched as the senior took careful notes, but she could tell he wasn't particularly curious about anything she said. In fact, after a half hour or so, he thanked her politely and stood to leave. As he was doing so, he tucked his pad inside a folder, which the manager noticed was completely covered with intricate drawings of cars. "Wow, these are amazing. Who did them?" she asked. Suddenly, the senior was filled with energy. "I did. I'm always drawing cars," he said. "My dorm room is covered with posters and paintings of cars. I subscribe to every car magazine. I've been obsessed with cars since I was 5 years old. My whole life I've wanted to be a car designer. That's why I'm always going to car shows and NASCAR races. I went to Indianapolis last year. I drove there." The manager shook her head in disbelief. "You've got to go work in Detroit," she said. "Why in the world are you thinking about consulting or banking?" The senior deflated as quickly as he'd come to life. "My dad says the car business is not what I went to Harvard for." For the next few minutes, the manager tried to change the student's mind, but she quickly realized she was getting drawn into family dynamics that were none of her business. She was not surprised a few months later when she bumped into the young man's father, and he proudly told her that his son was working 80-hour weeks at a Wall Street firm. Look, over the course of our careers, we all take jobs to meet the needs or dreams of other people. Parents, spouses, teachers, or classmates. That's not necessarily wrong, unless you don't realize you're doing it. Because working to fulfill someone else's needs or dreams almost always catches up with you. I know someone who literally became a doctor because his entire childhood, his mother, a Polish immigrant who loved the American dream, introduced him by saying, "And here's my doctor." He didn't hate the profession, but you've never met anyone more eager to retire. Similarly, there are countless stories of people who take jobs because their spouses want them to travel less. Then what invariably happens is that the compromising partner loses out on a promotion because of curtailed mobility. Sometimes blame gets flung everywhere. Other times it just sits there and simmers. The hard reality is there is no foolproof way out of the ownership bind. Especially as you get older, life and relationships can be complicated. Very few people have the total freedom and independence to take a job just for themselves. There are tuitions to pay, spouses with their own careers, and yes, inner voices saying what you should do with your life, even when you're long past being a college senior. That is why the only real defense against job ownership backfiring is to be explicit with yourself about the person or people for whom you are taking your job. Over the course of your career, your Detroit will surely call you at one point or another. If you can go, that's great. If you can't, make peace with the reasons why. Work content is our last signal, but it could just as easily come first. Every job has bad days or rough periods. And yes, there'll be times when you work mainly to make ends meet. But in the very best job scenario, you love the work, at least something about it. It just excites you. The customers, the travel, the camaraderie at the Tuesday morning sales meeting, whatever. Something about the job makes you want to come back day after day. Sometimes it is the sheer challenge of the job that turns your crank. Take the case of Joel Klein, the Chancellor of the New York City Department of Education. I've gotten to know Joel through my work with the school system's Leadership Academy for Principals. It is no exaggeration to say that Joel could have any number of prestigious, high-paying jobs as a corporate general counsel or CEO. As the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division in the 1990s, he took on Microsoft in a highly publicized battle, and later was chairman and CEO of the U.S. Division of Bertelsmann, the global media company. There is no glamour and very little glory in the school reform job Joel accepted in 2002. It goes without saying he took a massive pay cut to become chancellor, but in taking the job, Joel also agreed to deconstruct an insanely bureaucratic system with about 1 million students in more than 1,300 schools and a $15 billion budget. He immediately encountered entrenched interests, including fierce union leaders who were hell-bent on keeping the status quo. But in the face of that, he remained steadfast. Virtually every day, Joel appears in one of the New York papers, and because everyone has an opinion on education, he is often the subject of editorials, both laudatory and critical. Yet Joel could not love his work more. Sometimes I ask myself, what am I doing here? I could be eating a very nice, civilized lunch in a corporate dining room right now. And instead, I'm in a high-crime school trying to get staff to work together to enforce our discipline code, Joel once told me. But I grew up in public housing in Queens, and I'm a product of inner-city New York public schools. I owe a lot to the principals and teachers who invested their lives in the system and changed my life and the vision of my opportunities. I'm lucky enough to be in a position to give something back. I don't want to sound pompous, but this work feels more important than anything I've ever done. On a much smaller scale, I know what he means about a job feeling meaningful. My work always felt really significant, even when, in retrospect, it was hardly that. I'll never forget when I was a teaching assistant at the University of Illinois, and I was asked to present my PhD thesis on dropwise condensation to an international conference on heat transfer that was being held in Boulder, Colorado. You would have thought I was in the running for the Nobel Prize. I was a nervous wreck before my lecture and practiced for weeks. When the big day arrived, I spoke and received the polite applause I deserved. That didn't stop me from rushing to the phone to call my mother in a state of complete exhilaration. To tell you the truth, I still remember the excitement of that day. Luckily, finding a job that touches your core is not hard. Such jobs are everywhere. Every piece of work has the potential, since it only has to feel important to you. Shortly after I retired from GE, we were in Montreal, eating dinner at a small French restaurant, where we fell into conversation with a fellow tourist. Within a few minutes, we learned that this fellow was the first mercury-free dentist in Queechy, Vermont. You could feel the pride bursting out of his chest. Now, I didn't want to suddenly start a second career as a dentist, but his enthusiasm sure was infectious. As I said before, every job has its ups and downs, but if a job doesn't excite you on some level, just because of the stuff of it, don't settle. And don't worry either about knowing when you find a job with meaning. You'll feel it. Now let's look at those special cases I mentioned at the beginning. The job fit signals can be applied across pretty much all job situations, but some special cases call for more specific discussion. The first is finding your first real job. For a few lucky people, this process is relatively straightforward. They've got great grades from a quality school and some impressive work experience along the way. These new graduates, out of college or recent MBAs, usually have plenty of options. And I hope the signals in this chapter will be helpful in choosing wisely. Many people, however, do not get their pick of first job assignments. Their school record is only okay. Their job experience is not particularly special. That puts them in a position where they have to sell themselves to an audience that ranges from skeptical to downright negative. If you're in that category, my strong advice is just be real and come clean. There is nothing less appealing than an applicant with a so-so record overselling himself with a lot of bravado or over-eagerness. It's just so phony, and experienced managers can smell the fakery a mile away. The best thing you can do is tell your true story. Okay, I know my grades aren't that great, you might say. I spent a lot of time playing intramural sports, and to be honest, a lot of time with my friends. I definitely could have studied more, but I had other priorities, which probably weren't the best ones. The reason you should still hire me is because I never give up on a challenge. I work hard, I believe in your product, and I admire your company, and I know I can contribute here. While you're telling your true story, act like your true self. If you are generally outspoken and funny, don't act stiff and serious during your interviews. If you are a nerd, don't try to act slick. The company should know what it's getting, and you should show them so you see how they react. I know of an MBA who tripped over a door jamb on her way into an interview with three executives at a prestigious consulting firm. After scrambling back to her feet, she shook hands with her interviewer, saying, "And I'm Grace, the ballet teacher." None of them cracked a smile, nor did they try to put her at ease after what was obviously an embarrassing moment. She ended up being offered the job. She declined. "They saw the real me, and I saw the real them," she recalls. My main point is, when going after your first job, live in your own skin and be comfortable there. Authenticity may be the best selling point you've got. The second special job situation is when you are stuck in a position and see no way out. There are a slew of ways to get stuck in a job. There is nowhere to move up, since your boss isn't going anywhere, and he has no interest in pushing you for a job in another division. You've been passed over for a promotion, and you've been told you're fine where you are, but you're not moving on anytime soon. Or your company promotes people only after a certain period of time, which is a long way off. You love your job, but the money's bad. Or the money's great, but your job is lousy. The list alone could make you want to scream. And that's the problem with being stuck. Frustration builds and builds until people generally do something stupid. They quit. Don't do that. It's much, much easier to get a job from a job. I would even go further and say, not only should you stay put, you should work harder. Nothing will get you a new job faster than terrific performance in your old one. Jerry Roach, senior chairman of Heidrick & Struggles and one of the most respected headhunters in the United States, says that even if you feel stuck, if you're performing well, two outside observers are likely to know: headhunters and competitors. Great performers are like the masts of the tall ships, Jerry said to me recently. We can see them over the horizon, and we're always trying to bring them in to our port. By contrast, the worst kind of job seekers are those Jerry called perennials. These types are never moving up fast enough, or they can't stand their jobs, so they're always out there with their resumes and their phone calls, hounding us or hounding companies to hire them, he said. These people pretty quickly get themselves labeled. Obviously, if you're stuck, you need to put feelers out there to let people know you're thinking of moving. Just don't make it your purpose in life, or you'll undermine your effort, and worse, you'll take your eye off your best hope for getting unstuck, your performance. The third special case is finding a job after you've been let go. Last year, I had lunch with a former GE executive. Let's call him Charlie, who had once worked for me in a staff position before moving into operations. After several promotions, he landed in a job where he struggled for a couple of years to meet his numbers. Finally, in his early 50s, he was let go. Charlie's career, however, hardly ended. After a few months, he became a partner at a high technology company, starting part-time and quickly being drawn into a full-time role. From there, he was asked to join several corporate boards, and he also started teaching at a well-known business school. 5 years after being let go, he told me, his work was more fulfilling than ever. I asked him how he'd come back so strong. "Listen, I screwed up," he said. "My boss and I had agreed to clear-cut objectives, and I missed them. I waited too long to let go of two direct reports who weren't delivering. I didn't take costs out fast enough when the downturn was approaching. I was just too optimistic. I told my wife I was going to get it, and I did." Charlie's rational response floored me, because usually after people have been let go, they become very defensive and depressed. Both conditions, albeit natural and common, are what kill you when you go out to get a job again. An employer can pick up low self-esteem across the room, and people want to hire winners. But how do you act like a winner when you feel like a loser? I asked Charlie that question. His approach, he said, was to draw on what he called his reservoir of self-confidence, his strong family, and his store of positive feelings about himself and his achievements in the past. He used that internal capital to stay connected with business colleagues and to network for new opportunities. He also used it to stay active socially and in community activities. At first, maybe people were looking at me differently and talking about me because I wasn't working anymore, Charlie said. I tried not to pay attention to that. The goal, if you've been let go, is to stay out of what I have always referred to as the vortex of defeat, in which you let yourself spiral into inertia and despair. One reason why people often get sucked into the vortex is that they wait too long before they start looking for another job. This is a tricky matter. It makes a lot of sense to take some time off after you are let go, say a month or two, to reflect and compose yourself. On the other hand, the more you wait, the more likely you are to start doubting yourself, and the more likely it is that prospective employers will think something is wrong. You just don't want any hole in your resume to be too gaping. Prospective employers will, of course, ask you about why you left your last job. Come right out and say you were asked to move on. Every manager in the world knows what "I resign" or "I left for personal reasons" really means. Just as important, take responsibility for your departure, like my friend Charlie did in our conversation. His ownership of the situation made him infinitely more appealing than the typical kind of defense I heard 100 times. "Oh, my boss was really difficult." "Oh, they don't care about customers as much as I do." "Oh, my favorite. It was all politics there. It never mattered what you did. All that mattered was who you knew." Compare that to Charlie's approach, even recognizing that he is on the far end of rationality. When he got back into the job market, he didn't blame a soul but himself. He told interviewers what he learned from the experience and what he would do differently in his next job. "I'm determined to be more externally focused from now on," he said, "and I will definitely move faster on underperforming people. One of my objectives is to prove I don't make the same mistakes twice." If you've been let go, you never want to present yourself with a swagger. But you do need to project realism and optimism. Draw on your reservoir of confidence. Say what happened. Say what you've learned. And never be afraid to ask, just give me a chance. Someone will. Due to my vintage, I belong to a very small club. People who have spent their whole careers at one company. When I got my degree from graduate school in 1961, that was the norm. Today's statistics show that college graduates change companies multiple times in their first decade out, and newly minted MBAs do the same. I can't say if that's good or bad. It just is. People are very hungry to hurry up and find the right job. Here are some thoughts, though. First, finding the right job takes time and experimentation and patience. After all, you have to work at something for a while before you know if you can even do it, let alone if it feels right. Second, finding the right job gets easier and easier the better you are. Maybe that sounds harsh, but it's just reality. At the end of the day, talented people have their pick of opportunities. The right jobs find them. So if you really want to find a great job, choose something you love to do. Make sure you're with people you like, and then give it your all. If you do that, you're sure to have a great job, and you'll never really work another day in your life. The previous chapter of this book was about finding your right job. This chapter is about getting your next one. Now, not everyone in business wants to get a bigger and better job, but a lot of people do. If you're among them, this chapter is for you, whether you are hungry for your first promotion or your fifth. I was there once. When I started my career at age 24, I had no idea where I was going or how I was going to get there, but I was filled with ambition. The drive to, quote, make something of myself had started pretty young. I had my first job at age 10 as a caddy at a country club near my hometown of Salem, Massachusetts. Through high school and college, I held one job after another, from bartender to teaching assistant. By the time I graduated from the University of Illinois with a PhD in chemical engineering in 1961, I was eager for the real thing. The job GE offered me seemed like a good deal. I'd be working in the lab developing a new plastic, and if it succeeded, I saw a chance to get out in the field and sell it. Best of all, the job was in Massachusetts, and it paid the most of any offer, $10,500. Believe me, I wasn't thinking about a career at that point. If I had, I would have surely taken the offer I had received from Exxon, where a chemical engineering degree really meant something. But forget it. Exxon was in Texas. At that point in my life, the fact that I had gone to school in Illinois already made me feel like I had traveled halfway around the world. Over the next 13 years at GE, I got 4 promotions. Each one felt terrific. I liked having more responsibility, making bigger deals, building bigger plants, and managing more people. It was really only in 1973 that it dawned on me that I had a shot at the company's top job, and that I wanted it, too. In an act of complete cockiness, I put that down in my performance evaluation under the question about career goals. 8 years later, I got my wish. So how did that happen? How does a person get promoted? The first answer is luck. All careers, no matter how scripted they appear, are shaped by some element of pure chance. Sometimes a person just happens to be in the right place at the right time, and he meets someone at an airport or party, for instance, and a career door swings open. We've all heard stories like that. Sometimes we don't even know luck is good until well after the fact. An old golfing friend of mine, Perry Ruddock, remembers being sorely disappointed when he was passed over for a promotion that was in France early in his career at the investment bank Smith Barney. He thought he had missed out on his best shot at making a name for himself in the company, not to mention the glamour of Paris in 1966. As luck would have it, 2 years after Perry would have left for the assignment abroad, another position at the company came open in New York, and he got it. In his new role, Perry, then 32, got to run the company's investment banking operations. And with a team of forward-thinking young bankers, he helped guide the company successfully through a challenging period of consolidation in the industry. To make a long story short, Perry was vice chairman of Smith Barney from 1985 until his retirement in 1991. But luck can also break the other way. Sometimes careers stall for no reason at all except bad timing. At the very least, careers can zig and zag for reasons beyond your control, like an acquisition or divestiture or a new boss with very different ideas about your future. Occasionally, you miss out on a promotion because of office politics or nepotism. Such setbacks can be terribly disheartening, enough to make you ask yourself, why the heck should I even try? Don't go there. In the long run, luck plays a smaller role in your career than the factors that are within your control. While I never sorted these factors out while I was working, I have thought a lot more about them lately because audiences ask so many career questions. They come in every variety. I like my staff job at headquarters, but I want to move into operations. What do I need to do to convince my boss I can make the change? Or, I don't have any chemistry with my mentor, but she's really important in my company. How can I get ahead when I don't have somebody pulling for me? Or I'm in manufacturing, but I want to move into marketing. Will I ever get out of the factory? Career concerns, incidentally, are not confined to any one country or any type of industry. In China, with its nascent market economy and egalitarian culture, business people are fiercely curious when they ask, what does it take to get ahead? And the same question has come at me in Portugal, France, Denmark, and even Slovakia, where capitalism is less than 15 years old. I think the same answer applies everywhere. Basically, getting promoted takes one do and one don't. Do deliver sensational performance far beyond expectations, and at every opportunity, expand your job beyond its official boundaries. And don't make your boss use political capital in order to champion you. These imperatives are not everything, of course. There are four other do's and one other don't, and we'll look at them in turn. But first, let's focus on the two big ones. When most people think about delivering sensational performance, they imagine beating agreed-upon performance goals. That's all well and good. But an even more effective way to get promoted is to expand your job's horizons to include bold and unexpected activities. Come up with a new concept or process that doesn't improve just your results, but your unit's results and the company's overall performance. Change your job in a way that makes people around you work better and your boss look smarter. Don't just do the predictable. I learned this lesson for myself my first year at GE while I was still working in the laboratory developing a new plastic called PPO. A vice president was coming to town, and my boss asked me to give him an update on our progress. Eager to impress both of them, I stayed late at work for a week, analyzing not only the economics of PPO, but of all the other engineering plastics in the industry. My final report included a 5-year outlook comparing the costs of products made by DuPont, Celanese, and Monsanto, and outlined a clear route to a competitive advantage for GE. My boss and the vice president were surprised, to put it mildly, and their incredibly positive response showed me the impact of giving people more than they expect. I would see this dynamic again and again over the next 40 years. Take the case of John Krenicki, who made everyone around and above him look better by expanding his job's horizons. GE sent John to Europe to manage its $100 million silicones business in 1997. It was by no means a plum assignment, but it gave John a chance to run his own show. The business, while number two globally, was a weak number six in the European market, mainly because its biggest cost, raw materials, had to be sourced from the United States. It just could not compete with the local players. Back at headquarters, everyone would have been happy if John had grown silicones by 8 to 10% a year by pulling the usual levers, on-time delivery to existing customers, finding new ones, and developing new products. But John had bigger ideas. He proposed building a new plant in Europe to produce his key raw material. The price tag was well over $100 million. We said, no way. But John couldn't accept that there wasn't a solution to his cost spine. He tried a long-shot approach. Expanding his job's horizons, he entered into talks with several European competitors in search of a partner who would bring local sourcing and technology expertise to the table in return for GE's global strength. After a long year of negotiations, John found what he needed, a silicone joint venture with a German company, Bayer, with GE holding a majority stake in the new company. I recently asked him about this experience. It was just persistence, I guess, he said. I knew we had to become self-sufficient somehow. If we had just kept doing things as usual, even if we grew the business by a reasonable amount, we never would have broken out. Today, the European silicones business is number two in the local market, and with a recent acquisition, its sales are more than $700 million. As for John, he was promoted in 1998 to CEO of GE Transportation, and in 2003 to CEO of GE's $8 billion plastics business. If exceeding expectations is the most reliable way to get ahead, the most reliable way to sabotage yourself is to be a thorn in your organization's rear end. Of course, no one sets out to do that, but it happens. And every time it does, you force your boss to use his political capital in order to defend you. At this point, probably most people are thinking, who, me? Make my boss use his political capital? Never. Well, think again. You can have the greatest results in the world, but if you don't live your company's values and behaviors, you run the risk of this happening. Take the case of an extremely smart and capable employee I'll call James. We hired James into our business development program at headquarters. This two-year up-or-out program was designed for MBAs who had been with consulting firms for 3 or 4 years and wanted to get off that track and into operations. To test them, we put them in short, intense field assignments, transferring GE's best practices from business to business. In most cases, one of our businesses would steal these MBAs from the program within a year and place them in meaningful operating positions. James was about 32 when we brought him in from a top-tier consulting firm where he had worked since graduating from business school. He was European, articulate, and as I said, very bright, with excellent experience consulting in several industries. We figured at least 3 GE businesses would be fighting over him within 6 months. A year came and went, and no one would touch him. I couldn't figure out why until I sat in on his first performance review with his boss and the HR team. There I learned that James came into the office at 10 or 11 each day and left late at 8 p.m. or so. Those were plenty of hours to put in, and that kind of schedule was fine for an individual contributor. We had people in R&D who liked to work at night, for instance, and people in sales who came and went according to the needs of their customers in three time zones. James's hours, however, were not going to make it in a company where line managers generally showed up at 8 a.m. or earlier, and every meeting and work routine revolved around that. But James didn't seem to care about GE's routines. He had his own way of doing things. I saw that dynamic up close when James called my assistant and asked for an appointment. When we got together, after a few minutes of chit-chat about his career, the real reason for his visit became clear. "Would it be okay," he asked, "if I flew my own plane to my meetings in the field?" I told him he was nuts. "Do that only if you want to piss everyone off," I said. "Your hours have already gotten you in enough trouble. That kind of showing off is going to kill you around here. It's not our culture." "But I pay for the gas." "This is not about the gas," I said. Despite James's disconnect with our values, he did land a job in operations. Because of his brain power, energy, and European background, I put him in charge of a relatively small, troubled business we had acquired in Europe. Two American transplants hadn't worked out. Putting James there was a classic corporate stuff job, in that I stuffed him, despite my misgivings, down the throat of the business. It didn't work. GE's European business culture wasn't any more amenable to James than its American one, and eventually he had to leave the company. In the end, there wasn't a person left with any desire to spend political capital on him. By contrast, take the story of Kevin Scherer, who started in the same business development program as James. Before joining GE, Kevin had received a degree in aeronautical engineering from the U.S. Naval Academy, served a four-year stint on nuclear attack submarines, and worked for 2 years at McKinsey & Company. Without question, he was as smart as James in terms of IQ. He was also industrious and, like James, ambitious, the latter of those traits mitigated by his maturity. Kevin knew that GE valued teamwork. He was the ultimate team player. He showed up early, worked incredibly hard, and never looked for personal credit. Kevin worked in business development for 2 years and spent the next 3 years in operations. By that time, he was so universally respected, we made a huge bet on him by offering him a position as one of the company's 100 vice presidents, running its marine and industrial turbine business. Unfortunately, the same day that we tried to promote him, Kevin told us he had decided to leave for a huge opportunity at MCI. We tried desperately to keep him, but he was determined to run his own show. He left MCI a few years later to become COO of Amgen, and in 2000 was appointed its CEO. In the years since Kevin joined Amgen, the company's market capitalization has grown from $7 billion to $84 billion. It was obvious from the beginning that Kevin was a star. He had everything going for him, starting with performance. And you can be sure no one ever had to expend a drop of political capital when they mentioned his name. No wonder his career has consisted of one promotion after another. Along with transgressing company values, there is a related but more egregious way that you can use up your boss's political capital. It has to do with character. That is, with the kinds of behaviors that can make people ask, "Hold on, can I really trust this person?" Take lack of candor. As I mentioned earlier in the chapter on candor, I'm not talking about bold-faced lying, but a tendency to withhold information. That behavior is far more common, and it frustrates bosses and teams to no end. We had a manager in one of our larger businesses whose results were quite good. But after several early promotions, his career hit a wall. The reason was, whenever he was in a business review our ideal proposal session, we had to pepper him with about 30 questions to get him to explain what was really going on. And even then, we didn't feel as if we were getting the whole story. All we got was hemming and hawing, and then a hesitant, "It's okay now," or a cagey sounding, "We've got it under control." At every HR review, I would ask his boss why this guy played his cards so close to the vest. "It's his personality," was the answer. "He's not a bad person. He just doesn't like to open up." "What's he hiding?" I asked. "Because when he withholds information the way he does, he just comes across as if he's not telling the truth. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that way." "Yeah, that's true. It bugs other people too. But he's not lying. He's just got it." "But we've got to talk about the business more openly." "Yeah, I know. It's frustrating. I'll tell him again." And back and forth like that. Eventually, his boss got tired of the routine, and soon thereafter, the 2KG manager was demoted. The point is, don't make your boss ask the perfect question to get information from you. If you want your character to stand up for you and make life easier for your boss, open up and tell it like it is. There's another behavior that will also force your boss to use political capital, because it really alienates people. It's wearing your career goals on your sleeve. With most people, ambition is a positive thing. It's fire in the belly. It's energy and optimism. It's pushing yourself and the organization forward so that everyone wins. Kevin Scherer had plenty of this kind of drive, and so do most people who succeed. Career lust looks different. It shows itself in tearing down the people around you, insulting or disparaging them in order to make your own candle burn brighter, as the old saying goes. It's covering up your mistakes, or worse, trying to blame them on someone else. It's hogging meetings. It's taking disproportionate credit for team success and gossiping incessantly about people and events in the office. It's seeing the company's organization chart as a chessboard and making an open display of watching the pieces move. If you've got this problem, your best hope is to repress it, fight it, and keep it out of sight. If you don't do that, when the time comes to be promoted, there won't be enough political capital in the world to save you. It's very hard to champion someone over the clamor of objecting coworkers. We've just looked at the two biggest factors in getting you promoted: getting great results while expanding your job's horizons, and not using up your boss's political capital. That said, there are four other do's that certainly help too, and one don't. The do's are: manage your relationships with your subordinates with the same carefulness that you manage the one with your boss. Get on the radar screen by being an early champion of your company's major projects or initiatives. Search out and relish the input of lots of mentors, realizing that mentors don't always look like mentors. Have a positive attitude and spread it around. The don't is, don't let setbacks break your stride. Let's look at the do's first. Every business advice book tells you to network with people within your company and industry. They tell you how important it is to build a mutually respectful bond with your boss. That's all good advice, and you should take it. But to get ahead, you also need to tend to your subordinates with the same level of attention and concern. The boss-subordinate relationship is easy to neglect. Your boss is in your face, and your peers are on your mind, while your subordinates generally do what you say. But be careful. because the boss-subordinate relationship can easily fall into two career-damaging traps. The first, and by far more common, occurs when you spend too much time managing up. As a result, you become too remote from your subordinates, and you end up losing their support and affection. The second occurs when you get too close to your employees, overstepping boundaries, and end up acting more like a buddy than a boss. Either way can catch up with you. Your goal in managing your relationships with subordinates is to try to walk the line between the two extremes. When the time comes for your promotion, the best thing employees can say about you is that you were fair, you cared, and you showed them tough love. I learned this lesson firsthand. In the final showdown for CEO of GE, I was strongly opposed by two powerful vice chairmen who supported their own candidates. Unbeknownst to me, I was really helped by my direct reports. I found out that they had advocated relentlessly for my promotion with Chairman Ray Jones, telling him I was tough but fair and that I would push GE harder and faster than any of the other CEO finalists. I'm not sure all of them like me. I was rough around the edges and pretty short on patience. But I guess they respected me for respecting them. And building relationships with them, not just when I needed them, but years before. Another way to help yourselves with promotions is to get on the radar screen. As I've said, the first and best way to get noticed is with results. But you can also raise your visibility by putting your hand up when the call comes for people to lead major projects and initiatives, in particular ones that don't have a whole lot of popularity at the outset. At GE, two of those were globalization, which we launched in earnest in the 1980s, and Six Sigma, which was launched in 1995. Wayne Hewitt is a perfect example of a person whose career benefited from this dynamic. Wayne was a 35-year-old manager when he took over Six Sigma program in plastics after running GE Plastics Pacific. Using Six Sigma, he and his team drastically reduced product variation and stretched plant capacity 30% with little additional investment. 3 years later, Wayne was promoted to the CEO of GE's $2 billion silicone business. Dan Henson is another case in point. Dan was running a GE Capital lending business in London when he had the courage to volunteer to spearhead Six Sigma throughout GE Capital, a business where a lot of people doubted it had any value. Dan found out exactly where Six Sigma applied and, equally important, where it did not. In 2 years, Dan achieved variation reduction in highly repetitive activities such as credit card processing and mortgage insurance applications, and the results were impressive. Today, Dan is CEO of one of GE Capital's largest businesses, Vendor Financial Services. GE is so big. If Wayne and Dan hadn't put themselves on the radar screen, who knows when they would have been made CEOs? Certainly, it would have happened eventually, but not nearly as quickly. The best proof of the radar screen dynamic is in the numbers. Today, more than half of the senior vice presidents reporting to Jeff Immelt have worked in global assignments, and one-third of the company's approximately 180 offices have significant Six Sigma experience. The third career do concerns mentors. A burning topic while I was at GE, and these days, wherever I speak. People, it seems, are always looking for that one right mentor to get them ahead. But in my experience, there is no one right mentor. There are many right mentors. I had dozens of informal mentors over the course of my career, and each one taught me something important. My mentors ranged from the classic older and wiser executive, to co-workers who were often younger than I was. Some mentoring relationships lasted a lifetime. Others lasted just weeks. One of the most meaningful mentors in my life never called himself my mentor, nor did I ever identify him that way. I thought of Cy Cathcart, who was 10 years my senior and a member of the GE board, as my friend. To my great sadness, he died in 2002. Cy was everything people look for in a great mentor, a person who cheered me on and challenged me in equal measure. His judgment about people was pitch perfect, and I rarely made a big decision on hiring without running it by him first. During the toughest period of my career, when I was choosing a successor to recommend to the board, Cy spent several hundred hours over the course of 5 years visiting all of the candidates and sharing his impressions with me. Cy, the longtime chairman of Illinois Tool Works, was on the GE board when I became CEO. We played golf as often as we could and chatted on the phone regularly. Cy used both these venues to push my thinking up unseen alleys and around blind corners. "Are you sure that guy's not a phony?" he would ask. "Do you think that acquisition is still going to make you happy in a year when the fanfare dies down?" He always had the right question. I had another great mentor in Dennis Dammerman, who was not only younger than me by 10 years, but my subordinate as well. I met Dennis in 1977, when I was named head of GE's Consumer Products Group. I arrived in the job knowing basically nothing about insurance or financing, the main activities of GE Capital, one of the group's businesses. Dennis, whom I had hired as my financial analyst, had spent several years there. For months on end, Dennis taught me something every single day. His patience was remarkable. Here was his boss asking him to define the simplest concepts. I barely understood types of debt in those days. After all, I had come from the manufacturing side of GE. When we wanted money, all we did was make a pitch to corporate, and if the proposal was good enough, they sent it. Suddenly, I was dealing with combined ratios, delinquencies, leveraged leases, and the like. Dennis basically downloaded his brain into mine. He never called himself my mentor, but he was nothing less. There were countless other mentors who helped me in my career, from the executive education teacher who tried to teach me public speaking when I was 26, to the young woman in PR who tried to teach me the internet when I was 60. But let me just add to the list one more mentor that can work for everyone, the business media. Business is like any game. It has players, a language, a complex history, rules, controversies, and a rhythm. The media covers it all, and from every angle. From my earliest days in plastics, I learned mountains about business just by reading every financial newspaper and magazine I could get my hands on. From them, I picked up what deals worked and which failed and why. I followed people's careers. I tried to understand what kinds of strategic moves were criticized and which were praised. I kept up with different industries, from chemicals to medical technology. And I used what I read. I learned, for instance, about Pepsi's executive training program from an article in Fortune magazine. I was so impressed by the Pepsi model, which used the company's own executives as teachers, that I built it into the foundation of our training program in Crotonville. I don't believe everything I read, of course, and the more I knew, the more I realized that some articles were off the mark in their analysis. Regardless, I still believe the business media is such a good teacher that I am always amazed when I meet a young person who doesn't just consume it. Don't let that happen. This mentor is right there for the taking. My point is, that mentors are everywhere. Don't settle for the mentor assigned to you as part of a formal program. Those official mentors teach you the company ropes, but they're just a start. The best mentors help you in unplanned, unscripted ways. Relish all that they give you in whatever form they come. The fourth and final way to help yourself get promoted is as hard or easy as you make it. Have a positive attitude and spread it around. Yes, it's nothing more sophisticated than that. Have a sense of humor. Be fun to hang out with. Don't be a bore or a sourpuss. Don't act important or worse, pompous. Smack yourself in the head if you start taking yourself too seriously. In politics, people talk about each candidate's likability factor, which is just another way of saying personality appeal. Both of these terms refer to something intangible, but they really matter in politics and at work. Obviously, being a congenial, upbeat person will not get you ahead by itself. You need everything else we've just talked about. Great results, expanded job horizons, good character, visibility, mentors, and all the rest. But it is very, very hard to get ahead without being a positive person, because very simply, no one likes to work under or near a dark cloud, even if the cloud is very smart. I know it's not easy to be always upbeat. Life doesn't always go your way. But every time you feel yourself spreading gloom at work, think of Jimmy Dunn.